This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. We are in the thrust of summer 2013 cinema in Brooklyn, and in New York in general. But Brooklyn has all these fun festivals and series going on. Tickets are right now available for a bunch of them. As of today, if you're a member of BAM, you can get tickets for BAM Cinema Fest. In fact, later in this podcast, there's a segment where I talk with Florence Almozini, who is the programmer at BAM Cinematech, and she's the one who's been kind of driving that whole annual festival. And it was a nice talk. And so those tickets are on sale today for BAM members. And then I think in a few more days or next week sometime, the tickets go on sale to the general public. But actually, at this moment, you can get tickets to, I think, pretty much most of Rooftop Film's calendar. And you can get tickets for the Brooklyn Film Festival and also Northside Festival, which is a music festival as well, but it's also a film festival. In fact, FilmWax is involved in it. On this particular show today, there are two different filmmakers who I talked to. One was an interview with a young filmmaker named Jordan Vogt Roberts. This is his first feature. It's called The Kings of Summer. It screened with Rooftop this last weekend, and I just, unfortunately, I couldn't talk to him until the actual evening of the screening, and then we went off on our own and talked for a while during the screening. And so, but the good news is that if you weren't there, you can see the movie while it's playing in New York. It starts Friday the 31st of May for a week-long engagement. So, but if you're going to see The Kings of Summer, and Nick Offerman's in it, and Megan Mullally, and a bunch of other people, but if you do go to it, and I do strongly urge you to do so, go see it in the daytime, right? Or wait till Sunday, because, you know, opening weekend's so important. And yet at the same time, in the evening, there's Rooftop Film stuff, and I have to recommend you go see that stuff, because it's outstanding. On Friday night, you've got a block of shorts called Trapped, and then on Saturday night is a film by a Canadian filmmaker. His name is Matt Johnson, and he is on this show as well. That film is called The Dirties, and that is a really exceptional film. It's very disturbing stuff about bullying and school violence and filmmaking. It's a very original approach, and I really enjoyed seeing it. So I'm just trying to get you out there, guys. Have fun at the Open Road Rooftop at 350 Grand in Manhattan this weekend. The weather's supposed to really warm up and improve, so hopefully we've seen the last of the chilly, damp weather. I said just before that tickets were on sale for the Northside Festival, and I just want to say that on opening night of the film block of nights, which begins on Monday, June 17th, FilmWax will be partnering with Oscilloscope. I think I mentioned this before, and we're going to present the New York debut of A Teacher, Hannah Fadel's Sundance and South by Southwest hit film, which stars Lindsay Burge. Hannah and Lindsay were on an earlier episode of FilmWax Radio. You can, I guess, I should have that number of that episode at hand, but I don't. But you can go back onto the Rooftop Films website or on iTunes and listen to that show. It's a pretty good show. I talked to them in Austin when they showed their film at South by Southwest. So anyway, they're going to be premiering their film here in New York with the Northside Festival. I think it's fantastic because I love the Northside Festival. It's operated by Elle Magazine, I believe. And this is their fourth year doing this festival, and it keeps getting better every year. So go to their website, Northside Festival, and go check out what they're doing. I mentioned that FilmWax, it started as a series back in February of 2011. The podcast began in September of 2011. I was doing the series for a good 6 to 8 months before, I forget the number of months, like 7 months before I started doing the podcast. But I still do events, and I haven't been doing quite so many because I've just been busy with this thing and other stuff. So, but I do want to also mention that before I mentioned the teacher screening with the Northside, well, that's going to be at Nighthawk, but I'm also, that's on the 17th of of June. And then also on the 4th of June at the Nighthawk, I'm hosting a DVD release party with Jonathan Couette, who made Tarnation all those years ago. And this party's for the DVD release of his latest documentary called Walk Away Renee. And we're going to both be there, and we're expecting quite a nice crowd. It's going to be at the Nighthawk Cinema, 8 o'clock on Tuesday, June 4th. So come on out for that. There is a Facebook event up, and yada, yada, yada. So those are my plugs. But I do want to stress that if you're listening to this, please, if you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to the podcast through iTunes. I need to get kind of like everybody to do that. So in lieu of my coming directly to you and your home or calling you, I'm pleading to do that and to let people know about it, because I want to make this a success, and I want to bring on great filmmakers and let you know about great films, but more importantly, just discuss and talk about filmmaking and art making, because really that's where this show, I want to get it to be about. You know, sure, talk about your latest project and how it's debuting next Friday, but also let's just talk about stuff that we love and feel passionate about. The show is evolving. I have all sorts of ideas where I'd like to see it go. I'd like you to be on board. I want your suggestions and your comments about what kind of stuff interests you. So feel free to contact me directly at adam@filmwax.com. And I will read your email. I will respond to you. So, and of course on iTunes, you can make comments and stuff like that, which is, I guess, how one finds out how one is doing. I have no idea at this point. I just started this new podcast of, you know, 2.0 with the Move to Rooftop. It's got a new format, and I hope people are listening and digging it. So that's it. So we're going to go first into my conversation with Jordan, and then the second segment, I think, is going to be with Florence Almozini of BAM Cinema Fest, and then finally with Matt Johnson from Toronto. We did it on the phone, but it sounds pretty good. All's well. Oh, and by the way, the music today on the podcast is from a musician named Hani Zara. I hope I got the name correctly. Anyway, I'm digging the music. They're going to be playing on Saturday night at Rooftop Films right before the Dirties screening. So if you're liking it, it's another reason to come on out on Saturday and enjoy. Well, the band goes on around 8:30. The film usually begins right around 9 o'clock, and then they have an after party at Fontana's on Eldridge and Grand, and I was there the other night enjoying my free Red Stripe. So come on out this weekend. All right, and maybe I'll run into you. Enjoy. Jordan Vogt Roberts.
That is right.
I'm so proud because it's. I think your last name is spelled with a G in it. R O G B E R T S or something like that. And no. We were talking about that a little earlier. But
no one can ever pronounce my last name, and it's the bane of my existence. I actually, you know, it's a funny story. I planned on dropping the Vogt part of my name. And then I found out there was a different Jordan Roberts, who's actually like a really well-known and respected writer. And so this guy who I didn't know completely changed the course of my life. And now him and I are really good friends. And it's funny.
Because, is that right?
Yeah. And it's funny because his real name isn't even Jordan Roberts. So that was like his stage name. So he chose a stage name that completely screwed me over. But it was just funny because we were just these like weird... He was like my nemesis. I didn't even know this guy. And we would go to lots, and or like we'd get sent the wrong emails from executives. Sure. And we were like, all right, we need to be friends at this point. So,
speaking of writers, though, I guess this was a collaboration with Chris Galletta, right? And you were basically fishing for your first narrative, your first featured film.
Yeah.
Something to do, something to work with.
I'd been looking for my first feature for a while, yeah.
And this came your way, fortunately. It's called The Kings of Summer.
It's called The Kings of Summer. It was originally called Toys House, and that's what it came to me as. Yeah, I'd just been searching for my first feature. You know, I'd been making shorts and commercials and web stuff and all sorts of things, but I moved out here and I got into this business because I love movies and I wanted to make features. And so this script came my way and I just totally fell in love right away.
Mm-hmm. You say you moved out here, but you're talking about LA, right?
Sorry, okay. my internal geography is so screwed up because I'm traveling so much. Yeah,
we're probably on iTunes right now, so here is
well, here literally we are. Everyone should know we're in a high school hallway. That's actually kind of surreal doing this interview.
But is it bringing back memories?
Yeah,
also?
I mean, me and my friends used to hang out in the hall and cause trouble. So this is great. Yeah.
One can only imagine the ghosts of the generations of troublemakers in these halls past.
Well, I also don't find many excuses to find myself in a high school these days. So anytime I can always go back, it's fun. But yeah, here for me is Los Angeles.
Yeah, but you're from Detroit.
From Detroit, yeah.
Detroit. The city itself? Or
about as close to the actual city as you can get. Mm-hmm. You know, 8 Mile. I basically am from 9 Mile. So, right. That's not a joke.
Like, no, I got it.
Yeah.
Understood. Well, let's recount a little bit of the story. I'll start it, but you please interrupt. It's basically about, we'll say it's about two friends, even though a third kid ends up joining them, but two friends who are both kind of miserable in their home lives at the, you know, they're in high school, but they're, right. And they're best friends, and they're both are kind of like just experiencing, miserable home lives.
Right. And the thing that I always add to that is that I think what's really interesting about the characters is that they're sort of self-inflicted outsiders. You know, like I firmly believe that so much of this is that they could get along with their parents and they could get along with the kids at school, but they sort of make this active decision to believe that they don't belong.
Mm. So is that part of like, not to go too far off subject, but an extension of Nerdist culture? You know, at the very beginning, there's this one scene that sticks, which... could have definitely taken the film in a very different tone. There are probably many points of departure, but this is it early on when he's talking to a girl he has a crush on, Kelly, right? Mm-hmm. And some bully basically just humiliates him,
right?
Which is then turned into a very funny comic bit. It's a very restrained film.
I think there's like a Nerdist element to that in the sense that, like, I just think our culture right now is so fragmented where everyone has their own little clique, and everyone, like, especially with the internet and with all of the options that we have these days, everyone's just able to be exactly what they want to be and to choose to believe exactly the world that they think they live in. And these boys happen to choose this path where they don't think that they think that their life is terrible. And I think that's a big thing. All teenagers think that to some degree, but I think these kids, you know, do it in a certain way. But, you know, so it's about these three sort of self-inflicted outsiders that, are fed up and decide to run away over the summer, but the way that they run away is to go out into the woods and to build a house, which is just sort of like a very throwback idea. You know, it reminds me of Amblin movies and Stand By Me and things like that, and a lot of it to me is about this sort of generational gap of saying the kids in Stand By Me could go out into the woods. They could do that. My generation can't.
Yeah.
You know, like, right. I come from a generation that we would rather, like, sit around and smoke weed, talk about how cool it would be to go out into the woods as opposed to actually doing it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they go out in the woods, they build this house, and then it's sort of this utopia for a second until shit inevitably hits the fan.
Yeah, because they're kids at the end of the day. And for if you could imagine, the house is like a treehouse on steroids. It's just a real patchwork of found pieces of property and of people's, you know, stolen things, bought things, that kind of thing. But it's in of itself a character in the film.
Yeah, it was a tough thing to design that. And Chris wrote me this incredible script, but he didn't give a lot of description on the things like the house itself. And so when I was pitching on the movie, one of the first things I did was start putting together concept art on what the house looked like and sort of created all these rules to say, like, okay, this house needs to feel real. It needs to feel like something that these kids could actually have built. with found materials if they did what we didn't do. You know, like if they actually went out there and they're like, we're going to do this. And for 2 weeks, we're going to put everything into this. And we're not going to slack off. And we're going to make this thing. So I wanted to ride this line between having it feel real and tangible and not overly art directed, but also not, you know, not have it be movie magic, but to still have it feel iconic, you know, and to still like get a sense of like wonder and idealism with it.
I wanted to mention that the whole part of the film, which is in the first third, where the house is being built, is a reflection of some good editing there. It had to be a little bit challenging how to pace that part of the film.
Man, that was an ordeal. You know, on a script level, it was like 45 pages before they got under the woods. Sometimes, this is not a comment on this script, but it's just a fact of life, which is sometimes the best scripts don't make great movies, and sometimes horrible scripts make great movies. And you know, there's just a real tough growing process that happens from script to screen. And we had all this great stuff and all these really unique situations. But at the end of the day, no matter what we did, I just had this really strong internal sense of we need to get them to the woods. We
faster.
Need faster, yeah. Faster, faster, right. Faster.
That's good. Yeah.
You know, and right now I think they wake up in the woods about 25 minutes in. The thing to me that I actually kind of really like about it is I really didn't want to give a lot of setup as to why things are bad and why they feel they need to leave, because to me, the beauty of it is like in this sort of story about kids in the video game generation, they don't really have a reason to leave. You know, it goes back to that like self-inflicted outsider idea where like things are great.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents love them, you know, and then they still choose to go because they're dumb kids, you know,
right.
Kids just make weird decisions. So we always knew that we could sort of fall back on that. And we didn't want to like overly explain it, but we also didn't want to cheat it. So it was a really difficult, sort of line to ride to get them there and to not have the audience feel like we cheated through something.
I must say also that if they hadn't chosen to build a house, it would be a much less interesting film.
It would have been a short film at that point.
It would have been a short. But let's talk about the parents, because they are some recognizable comedic actors in some of those roles, if not all of them. You have Nick Offerman, who plays Frank Toy, who is one of the, who's, let's say, Joe, his son, one of the kids, father, widow, recently widowed, and he really delivers a subdued performance. Not that he's ever off the wall. Nick Offerman is generally low key, from what I've seen.
No, he breaks out of the Ron Swanson stereotype, certainly. You know, there is like that dryness and that sarcasm that everyone loves from Nick, and sort of that arch quality.
Oh, totally. But, and he gets some of the film's biggest laughs.
But I think as the movie progresses, people realize that those laughs are actually coming from a place of actual pain and character. And I think that he does deliver a really strong performance that has real emotional weight to it. I think it catches a lot of people off guard,
right,
which is great.
And he avoids some of the pitfalls where a lot of scripts tend to go with widowed dads.
Right.
He's not, doesn't pull the grieving thing too much. It's just, he plays it just right. The tone is actually, I think, pitch perfect in a way.
Thank you. I mean, I love playing with tone. It makes me so sad that people want to put comedy in such a box and say that it just needs to be this or just needs to be that. And I mean, life's a spectrum, right? Life is high highs and low lows, and it's absurd and crazy and all of these things in the course of an hour, you know. And getting this tone was really, really tricky because we wanted to, you know, in my mind, I wanted to make a movie that had laughs as big as something like Superbad, but was still able to like visually engage you and to walk out and be like, wow, that was beautiful. And then to also be emotionally affected. Like, I think that none of those things are mutually exclusive from one another. And so, and I think if anything, like, I think a lot about movies like Up. I think Up is a perfect movie because it slaloms between, it's like moments of loss and aging and loneliness and like family-friendly slapstick, you know, and by weaving those two together, they become more poignant. And I love stuff like that. So,
yeah, no, I agree. I was lucky to have a small child when Up and also WALL-E came out, because I don't know that I would have given it as much attention, you know, or
all those Pixar movies are great.
Pretty amazing. Yeah. And I appreciate also earlier you referenced Amblin Films, and I see the connection to Rob Reiner's Stand By Me, and With Amblin, also the Goonies, you know, these films come to mind now that
Goonies
you mentioned
was a big, you know, look, I don't take this lightly at all, but like the fact that a lot of our reviews are even comparing us to Goonies or Stand By Me, in a positive way and sort of saying that this carves out its own place in like the coming of age story lore is incredible to me. Mm-hmm. 'Cause those were reference points to me, certainly when we were making this, and those are movies that I grew up on and inspired me. But
well, you walked in the building before with four women on your arms. Are you telling me that that's just typical of you?
If only that was true. Mm-hmm. No, in fact, I just broke up with my girlfriend. So any you know, babes listening to this podcast.
Oh, believe me. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's... I'm a real dork. I'm a real movie nerd. Like, and, you know, it's like... I think the most depressing thing of that big speech Soderbergh gave that I personally respond to the most about the state of the industry is just about how there's a huge lack of people in this industry who truly love cinema and understand like film history and have an appreciation for like the obscure and the weird and the greatest hits, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something that I just think is just...
Think about what Kings of Summer might have turned into if it had been a studio film.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff in this movie, and I think the things that I love about this movie are the things that are really, really weird and that I had to fight really, really hard for.
Yeah.
You know, and there's like weird lyrical, ethereal, like impressionistic elements in this film that are very much, you know, inspired by Malick and those movies that I love.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in fusing that with really alt comedy and just like really putting those back to back, because I'd never seen that before. There's so many things like that in this movie that would have just gotten ripped out right away, I think, in a traditional studio system. And Chris, the writer, and I were talking about this earlier today, where I think that like a lot of people, especially in the industry, look at this and they're like, wait, how did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, not necessarily about like, oh, it's really good or anything like that. Just more like, how did this not get killed? Like, how did this movie even get made? You know?
It does,
like,
Well, two things that come to mind and without creating a spoiler of some kind is there are relationships. There's three boys. We mentioned Joe, right? That's the one who basically gets the idea going, and who's Nick Offerman's dad. And then you have the Patrick, who is his best friend, and who his mom is played by Megan Mullally, who's married to Nick Offerman in real life, and then her husband, and they're overly doting, overbearing, and he, you know, so that kind of is the motivation for kind of driving Patrick to join in on the house. And then the third boy, who is recognizable to generations younger than I, from
Hannah Montana,
right? And that's Moises Arias.
Yeah.
And that character, I don't know that he would have made it in there, in quite that same way.
Not the same way.
But also, I think what I liked about the ending, and this is not a spoiler, is that there is a kind of a breach in the friendship, which is part of the tension of the film. You know, there's a subplot that we don't need to get into, but that at the end, because of the way you ended it, I would have bought either their friendship stays or doesn't. I didn't feel like, oh, he tied it up neatly because they smile, you know, at each other in the cars across from each other. That didn't necessarily signify, oh, they're back together either.
Right. That's really interesting. A lot of people, I think, interpret it as they've come to an understanding and they're back to being friends, and I don't necessarily see it that way. I think that they will forever cherish the time that they had and acknowledge how special that was. But I also think that a big part of that scene for me is that they are going different paths. Mm-hmm. They're you know, like...
Literally,
and
otherwise.
But they will, you know, everyone's got to grow up. And, you know, my best friend from when I was 10... is still someone that I never talk to anymore. Occasionally, maybe once a year, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
I'll always like have appreciation for who that person is, but like that doesn't mean we're friends now.
Right.
So
I understand.
But you know, going back to what you were saying earlier, like it, in terms of comedy, like we've got like Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally and Alison Brie and a ton of amazing comedians that I think people will really know more of in the next couple of years, that I think you'll just start seeing appear in more TV shows and movies, and just like a really incredible comedic cast. But to me, the movie really lives and dies by those kids, you know?
Absolutely. And that is the crux of the film. We should point out that, you know, as we tie up the description of the film in a way that, that for the most part, we're watching them live in this house over the course of the summer, and that they're missing. they're on, you know, basically milk carton kids, but, they, you know, we watch them on their day-to-day lives for a number of weeks living on their own. And, the three of them, and it's very entertaining. Those scenes are great.
Well, I think so much of it is about, I just knew that the movie rested on them, you know, and you needed kids who, you needed a chemistry amongst those kids that I think an audience members could step back from and really just look at the screen and have a handful of moments where you're like, oh, that right there, like that little tick or that little mannerism or that way that they interacted with each other. Like, that's what it was to be that age, you know? Like, and yeah, you just like, I think the reason people really respond to the movie is because I think it elicits a very intense sense of nostalgia for them, not only about what they experienced, but what they wish they experienced as well.
Hmm. And also in another dimension to it, the nostalgia is also cinema, because there are these references, whether they were conscious on your part, and I suspect most of them were, but like, you can now, knowing your passion or the inspiration that you derive from 80s coming of age films, that, you know, like John Hughes is there, as you said, there's even like the kinds of like those movies like Footloose and these other movies. I just see moments that are kind of quirky moments where they just sort of, you make these seemingly arbitrary little choices.
I love that era of filmmaking from the late 70s and into the 80s, because first and foremost, those movies, and I talk about this a lot, but those movies were films first and foremost. They were about characters and a story. And that's what you were hooked in.
Right.
And then if they were funny, adventurous, heartbreaking, whatever, that was all just bonus, you know, but you were there because you were watching a film, you know, or like Annie Hall is a film first and foremost, and it happens to be really funny and it happens to be really emotionally raw. And now we make content that I think is really, really disposable and forgettable, and that sucks.
Yeah.
But, you know, to me, the way that I always describe the movie, like when I was sort of constructing it, the idea was like, okay, let's take like the cinematic quality of Goonies, of Stand By Me, or even like the B-movie version of those, which is like The Explorers, mash that up with like the heart and the weight of sort of John Hughes movies, sprinkle in like some weird Robert Altman and some Terrence Malick, and then mash all of that up with like really, really contemporary alt comedy while still not trying to make it feel dated at all.
I just liked when you said Robert Altman, mash it up. It just kind of like, I know that wasn't conscious. You also use a very famous theatrical, a device in your film, which is called Chekhov's gun. I won't say any more about it, but do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And for those who don't, I'm not going to go on anymore. It's there, and I'm sorry to be so pretentious as to use that. I had to look. I actually did look at what that was called.
Oh yeah,
but I didn't. I knew the expression.
I love. But I didn't. I love when you get into all the nitty gritty of stuff like that. Like, I used to love in film school the fact that there's like terms for when sound is coming from an actual source in the scene versus versus just music. You know, like, it's called like diegetic versus like non-diegetic, but like no one in the right mind would ever say it by those terms.
Yeah,
and it's just one of those things. Even when I was in film school way back in the day, I was like, no one talks like that.
It's because you're in school, right? And another was Monopoly a large part of your childhood? No, it was written in, so I assume.
I played a lot of Monopoly, but...
I did when I was a little squirt.
You know, that was something that was in the script, and I think that there's a lot of layers to what's going on in those games, and a lot of symmetry, obviously. And it's funny, a review came out recently that Chris and I were talking about today that was, like, slamming us for, like... It was one of those reviews that was like reading way into the subtext. It was like slamming us for reinforcing capitalism or something like that.
Of course.
Because of Monopoly.
Right.
And it was like, okay, well, I mean, I'm sorry you misread the subtext there. But
there's nothing in this film. Like, there's no tech. There's like no technology. There's no, I don't remember. Maybe there's phones, I guess. But there, I mean, you're, it's just, it's like a very analog film.
There's phones, but even with the phones, like one kid has an iPhone, one has a flip phone, and one has a beeper. You know, like the whole thing was designed to be very era-less.
Yeah. And one other thing I didn't know until I read about it in the notes is that this takes place, that it was filmed, rather, doesn't take place, but it was filmed in Chagrin Falls.
Chagrin Falls, Ohio.
And I have family there.
Oh, really?
And I've been there a bunch of times.
Yeah, Chagrin Falls, aggressively quaint is what they call it. And that was actually like an interesting thing because Chagrin Falls is where Bill Watterson, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes, is from.
Mm-hmm.
And when making this movie, one of the...
My ride is here. Excuse me.
One of the quotes that always stuck with me for a long time was this quote by Bill Watterson that said, "Anyone who's nostalgic about their childhood never had one." And I thought that was such an interesting quote to come from someone who made this work of art that's like so pure and so like joyful, but there's like a real darkness to that as well, especially with like the parents in that. And so I was always fascinated with how someone like that could reconcile a quote like that. So then to be in Chagrin Falls, where he's from, shooting this movie that has a lot of very thematic similarities, I really wanted to reach out to him. But he's like a recluse, you know, and I just...
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, he's a huge recluse. And I didn't want to be that guy who's like,
Hey, I know that you I know you don't like dealing with strangers, but hi.
Like, I didn't want to be that schmuck.
Well, now you mention it, I mean, Peanuts was definitely had the same kind of thing. It was very dark.
Oh, yeah, I love...
With the disconnect.
I love early Peanuts. Schultz is a big influence.
Well, the movie is called The Kings of Summer. And actually, as we are speaking in this high school, as you pointed out, your screening is taking place downstairs.
The screening at Rooftop is taking place right now.
Actually, let's not even remind people that it's inside because of the weather. But we're at a rooftop event. We're at your rooftop event, and so right now there's hundreds of people just close by and laughing and
hopefully
I heard already at the start but it's also having a theatrical
on New York 31st? And LA
May 31st,
and then we start expanding out, and you know it's tricky because already online and like there's a lot of film bloggers and a lot of people are really championing this movie, which is great. That's all I could have ever wanted. And to take it to a place like Rooftop is incredible because those are people that are, the audience here is so hip and with it and great.
And they love movies.
And they love movies. And they take them seriously. Yeah. But, you know, it's just tough. Like a movie like this, really, it's a word of mouth movie. It's just going to live and die by whether people can find it and whether people fall in love with it and want to champion it. Like that's completely what this movie rests on.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody listening, if they don't want like Iron Man 4000,
I think that's Fast and Furious 4000.
I actually like the Fast and Furious.
I know,
franchise.
Actually, but I'm just saying numerically. But I was hearing some actually. I doesn't take itself quite so seriously as a lot of the other franchises.
It's very aware of what it is.
Yeah.
And it's like very, all the characters are very crystallized, and like it just knows exactly what it wants to be right now, and it's great. And it's like I love those movies because they're just about like family, beer, cars, girls.
Not in that order.
Tough.
Yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous. But yeah, we open May 31st, and then we start expanding. And yeah, I mean, it's just, if you believe that comedy can be smart, if you believe that, like, movies can engage you on multiple levels, or you care about the technical aspect of filmmaking at all, like, I would urge any of you, your listeners, to go and watch a movie that I think will simultaneously really make them laugh. And ideally, for me, I just want people to leave the theater and say, "God damn, being 14 was the best." And then immediately follow it up with, "Thank God I'm done with that," because that's the most painful, awkward time of my life. But it's inevitably what makes you who you are. You know, that's the time that really leads you to find yourself.
Perfect place to leave it. Jordan Voot Roberts, thanks a lot for visiting Filmwax Radio.
Thank you for having me, of course. Absolutely. Right. Please help spread the word.
Yes.
So
I'll do my bidding. I'll do your bidding, I should say.
Thank you.
I'll do my best.
swimming fast, chasing flies and demons cast from you.
And up next is Florence Almozini from BAM as we discuss the upcoming season of BAM Cinema Fest. Hi, Florence. Florence Almozini. It's a pleasure to finally have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I've been chasing you down for years now. Finally, success!
I disappear all the time in the dark screening rooms. No one knows where I am.
Oh, really? I was wondering where you were hiding out. As every summer comes about and you guys announce the new BAM Cinema Fest, I call it the highlight of the summer. You guys can't really do that because you have other series going on and retrospectives potentially, so you can't.
Well,
you know.
Yeah, I know we have to treat every program equally.
Yeah.
But we do love Cinema Fest, and mm-hmm. we're very, very excited to have it every year. And mm-hmm. when we announce it, we feel like finally the child has come out. We're very, very excited.
Right. So the weeks and months leading up to it is like a pregnancy.
Yeah.
The days ahead are like labor.
It's a long pregnancy and delivery.
Yeah.
But it's always worth it. This year, it's a really great kid.
Let's get away from this metaphor, because I would say, when do you start the, when does it begin? when does the programming, when does the...
The process.
Yeah, when does the programming process truly begin? Like, I'm going to guess, but interrupt me, that with going to Sundance,
Pretty much, yeah. It really starts with the Sundance season to South By. Obviously, there's always... It's always in our mind because we do it every year, so we can, you know, I can start seeing and thinking about it from Cannes to Toronto or whenever I get submission. So the seeds like comes, you know, like it's all year round. If you see a great film or someone, you know, a filmmaker, you know, and you know his project's going to be done around that time, it's already there. But then really, really the main core of the programming and setting up everything starts with Sundance.
Yeah.
And there's no joking around anymore.
All business. Correct me also if I'm wrong, but it's sort of started before BAM Cinefest was the official name. It sort of started as like a Sundance and at BAM kind of theme, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like loosely for a couple of summers?
Yeah, we had a three-year collaboration with the Sundance Institute.
Okay.
So it was called, not very originally, but it worked. It was Sundance at BAM.
Yeah, I like that.
And it was pretty easy to work with Sundance and get the film from the festival. Mm-hmm. We loved it. It was a great collaboration. We've made a lot of good contact over there with the festival and filmmakers, institutes, like everyone. And when it was over, we just felt like, well, let's do something on that range, but a little more creative. So it's not just Sundance. We can build from that. We can get film from other festivals. We can get film that are submitted to us directly.
They are.
You know, it's just like it opens the gate and the door a little bit.
Right. More options.
We keep, yeah, exactly. But we keep building on what we started already. So
is there some sort of formula or some sort of equation where, you know, 30% of the films are going to be Sundance, 20% we're going to hold off for wild cards, meaning, you know, films that we do come across maybe throughout the year?
There's no formula or quota or films. I think it's like what worked for us, it's like we love the film equally and we have to feel completely enthusiastic about any film at any moment. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Sundance is a major festival for new American independents, so we will always get more films from Sundance. Mm-hmm. But it's also a very competitive environment. Mm-hmm. When you go to screening there, you see everyone else from New York. You see all the studios, all the distributors, all the competitors from other venues. You know that Tribeca, new director, Rooftop will be there. Mm-hmm. So we have a tendency to, you know, just like, oh, I want this one. I wonder who's going to get it.
Right.
Like, not really a fight, but like a race to like send your request first and just being the most attractive and appealing.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously it's a big festival, but we, you know, we all have different timings, so that can play also in who's going to get the film.
Mm-hmm.
We have different collaboration and relationship with filmmakers or studios or distributors that might prefer a venue to another. So we you know, even so, we're the youngest. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of appeal and assets that can make it work for us. But there's no, yeah, exactly. There's no, like, we need to get 50% from Sundance and then we right. fill it with anything else. So.
And it, I didn't realize that you got submissions.
We don't look for submission. They find us anyway. So we've decided to embrace
unsolicited.
It.
Unsolicited.
Yeah. It's a lot of work. I think we got over 200 this year. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of films.
That is a lot. And you watch them all, you guys?
Well, I mean, if someone, you know, send a submission and we think there's a chance it could be interesting, we have to look at it.
Do we want to advertise that? Do I want to bring it up?
Well, it's late for this year, so we can advertise it for next year.
True.
Maybe
so don't
we'll
send, if you're here
process.
Listening to this, don't bother sending anything in quite yet. Let them get their, you know, let them get
staff.
Their let them get their pre-pregnancy weight back.
But yeah, we do. We every year we get submission and films we really like. We got The Color Wheel as a submission. I didn't know Alex Ross Perry at the time. Mm-hmm. We got some submission also this year from him that got into the festival. So
right.
you know, there's hope for everyone, even if you're not in Sundance or South By, or if you don't know anyone at Cinematheque or BAMROS. You know.
Yeah. Last question about programming approach or style, and that is Brooklyn. You're here. You're a Brooklyn institution, one of the oldest ones. I mean that offer the arts and specifically film. And I'm wondering, do you also have a conscious effort to make sure that there are Brooklyn films in the series? It appears like you do. Like you just mentioned, Alex's film, Color Wheel.
It does. Which, mm-hmm. But the same, there's no quota. It's not like, oh, yeah. I need 50 films from right. Brooklyn. It turns out a lot of filmmakers live in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And they would know about BAM, so they think of us more than people who would not live in Brooklyn or New York.
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't know where people are from, and it's like a surprise when I'm like, oh, let's talk about the travel arrangements. Like, oh, I live down the block. I'm like, oh, well, that's easy. I had no idea you were from Brooklyn. And I try not to know because I don't want to be influenced when I see a film. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some directors, I know they're from Brooklyn because we've showed their film before, like in the festival, outside of the festival, like Andrew Dusumnu from Mother of George. I know he's local. So it's always a great extra bonus. But if someone is a great film, no matter where he's from, I think, you know, he shouldn't mm-hmm. play a part in the selection.
Well, the festival this summer is running from June 19th to the 28th. And your opening film is David Lowery's Ain't Them Body Saints, which I know it was a hit at Sundance and has been getting a lot of early buzz. You know, people are definitely talking about it. I haven't seen it. I'm very excited to see it.
There's some buzz. It was really hard to see it in Sundance.
It was?
It was really hard. There was a lot of buzz. It was really hard to
So it was hard to get a seat, yeah.
Yes.
But you forced your way.
And I hope people will have a chance to see it now.
Yeah.
It's playing here in our largest new venue, 800 seats in the Harvest Theater.
Where?
We are going to have an opening night at the Harvest Theater.
Where's
across
that?
The street.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So it's uh-huh. it's a really beautiful venue.
Oh, terrific.
Really
I can't
excited
wait.
About this. Yeah, the film is amazing.
It's called the Harvest Theater?
The Harvey.
Harvey Theater. Mm-hmm. All right, Harvey. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
It starts with an H. It starts for me.
I understand. that's David Lowery's film, Ain't Them Body Saints, and that's on the opening night, I guess, on the 19th
of
June.
Correct.
It's coming up fast. And then a film I did get to see at South by Southwest is Short Term 12, Destin Cretton. Is that mm-hmm. how you pronounce it?
Yes, correct.
His film, and that's the closing night film.
Yes.
Right? It seems like it would be a tough choice to figure out, because you're definitely saying these are our, you know, these are the ones we're really hoping to bring out the crowds, and that will
Absolutely.
We're really, really the most.
When I saw Short Term 12, I didn't really know about it. I saw
his
previous film, but it was, you know, it was kind of like a little unexpected in a small screening room in South By. And Avoli was really terrific. I was really touched by it.
Yeah.
The filmmaking skills were incredible. The acting was amazing. And I was thinking, this is what we do in Cinema Fest. We don't need, like, a marquee name, necessarily. It'd be great to just, like, bring this and give it, like, the profile it deserves mm-hmm. And do it as our closing night. So people will definitely pay more attention. Again, we'll be in the same beautiful Harvey mm-hmm. Theater.
At the Harvey Theater.
With H. With director and cast. And I think people will connect with the film. It's really, really touching and beautiful.
we'll hopefully have on these filmmakers on the podcast too shortly. I'm going to mention a couple that I've seen and that actually already, like Martha Shane and Lana Wilson, were on this podcast with their new film about late-term abortion, a particular late-term abortion clinic. And that film is called After Tiller, named after George Tiller, the abortionist doctor who was assassinated basically in a church. Or no, it wasn't, right? He was first, it was
outside of his clinic.
It was, there was actually two, he was shot twice. First time in a church. Second time he was killed, outside of his clinic. Computer Chess, Andrew Bajalski's.
Oh, you saw Computer Chess.
I did, and that is a really unique narrative film.
I know, people think it's a documentary. I mean, there's a documentary feel to it, in a way, but it's fiction.
And not only because of the style, but because also the way it looks. I mean, it really looks authentically like an 80s,
I loved this film, and we were really, really excited that we could give it a New York premiere. I knew there was a lot of competition for people to show it, but we had a great relationship with Andrew Bujalski. We've shown all his films, and this one was really, really outstanding.
And it's outstanding in the terms of its quality, but also from his own group of films that he's made. It doesn't look like anything he's made
from
before.
From his trajectory in filmmaking also.
Yeah.
But I mean, I knew I went to see it because I love his film.
Yes.
So, you know, when you go to a festival and you have like 400 different choices of films, I was like, oh, I always love Andrew's
film. That's an easy one.
I really want to see that. And
if they didn't, if there were no credits on it, though, would you have known it was an Andrew Bujalski film?
I doubt it.
Yeah, me too.
I'm not going to pretend I'm like super smart and know everything. There's some details. There's some clues somewhere. You would know. Like, I don't think I would.
No, not with this one. I can go through. Why don't you talk about some of the films that maybe that? Also, by the way, just off the record, if there's, it's always kind of like tricky how you choose which ones to talk about. Of course, so we want to make it clear like that these are not favorites in particular.
Yes, we want to make sure that I understand. All the films. They're all great.
Right. Florence and I were talking about, we're talking the day after Mother's Day and how she loves all of her films equally. So there's the fact that we may omit some from our conversation or speak about some doesn't in any way suggest preference.
I love Museum Hours by Jim Kahn.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
It's playing on Monday night, June 24th. Mm-hmm. Jim is a great artist. We've shown some of his film here before, and he's going to be back in the fall. I fell in love with Museum Hours. It's something I would absolutely recommend. But also, it's opening that same week. He has a distributor. So,
did you know that when you scheduled or programmed it, that it was opening?
I thought it was supposed to open before us. So I was like, well, I guess I can show it.
But as I always say, by the way, Florence, that just because it's opening theatrically, you would have a greater chance of engaging with the filmmaker and having a festival experience by coming and seeing it at Banff Cinefest, which it's much more, I think, dimensional experience or exciting experience to come to Cinema Fest and see it then.
No, it's true. I mean, the filmmaker they all make an effort to come here to participate with Q&As, to meet with the audience. They also get a chance to meet other filmmakers and start collaboration or discussion, which is always kind of fun. So it's like, you know.
Do you consider adding any other kinds of panels or conversations, or have you considered doing that, or is that like outside of the?
No. I mean, some films work very well with a panel. There's some documentaries that demands it really because you want to explore the topic. So we're showing. I don't know if we will do panels specifically on VS, but like God Love Uganda, I think deserve some longer conversation about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very upsetting to me when I saw it.
Yeah.
The topic is very strong. Have you seen it, or do you know what it's
about? No, I haven't seen this one, though.
Okay, so
I haven't seen it.
It's really about like American Christian going to Uganda and explain how bad homosexuality is.
Oh, yes. So it's about homosexuality and how
it's perceived and illegal.
Right.
When people get killed for it in Uganda, starting by American paralyzation from the Christian side.
So
there's a remote area medical also.
I saw that.
That could have some fun discussion about healthcare, system and people who are left out of it, and you know,
this is a really
and possible solution what people offer.
It's an amazing film. It's a mobile. Is it in Tennessee? Thanks.
I wasn't planning on visiting soon. So.
I'm going to guess it was probably closer to the Appalachian side, sort of the mm-hmm. eastern side of Tennessee, right, to the state. Anyway, they set up in different places, right? But this is an amazing thing where they set up a campground in a racetrack, I believe,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the racetrack is not being used.
No, it's not being used. Not technically, anyway. They set up this whole sort of hospital take care of people that can't otherwise don't have health care.
I know,
access.
And people line up for hours or
for
like
days yeah, even
just
days.
To hope to get like health care and dental care.
And
also.
Dental care. That seems to be almost the most important because people aren't able to really, their teeth are falling out of their heads. Oh. It's really tragic.
Yeah.
And also, what it does to one's confidence and how it undermines even getting a job. So it's amazing how dental is almost as if not more crucial mm-hmm. to people's sense of esteem than other kinds of physical care. You know,
and it's also incredibly expensive.
Yeah, and this is all being done pro bono. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of getting seen, and so you follow all these different folks that are waiting to be seen and are seen. It's a very moving film. Very moving film. I used to be darker. I always kind of like, you know, Matthew Porterfield, a big
yeah,
fan.
I love Matthew's films. I love
I
this,
haven't seen
one.
This one. Yeah.
One of the actress in the film is Kim Taylor, who's also going to be performing live after the screening in the BAM Cafe. So it's going to be a really great event.
It's about a couple that are both musicians and they're mm-hmm. splitting. I'm going by descriptions.
Yes.
I haven't seen
mm-hmm.
it yet, but that it's their last maybe days together in the house. And they have kids, right?
Yeah, interrupted by teenagers and their life. And it's they're in the middle of breaking up and mm-hmm. they have a runaway teenager in there.
And the director is Matthew Porterfield, who made Putty Hill a couple years ago. Newly Weeds, I've seen. That was...
That's a fun Friday night movie.
Yeah, that's right. And we're in no way condoning...
Yeah, we put something in the popcorn.
Make note of that.
COG, mm-hmm. that's showing on the 26th. It's based on a short story by David Sedaris.
Oh.
Crash Reel is great. It's a document. It's a verité documentary about this kid who was a skateboarder mm-hmm. competition with Shaun White. And mm-hmm. he crashed terribly before the Olympics and was in rehab. So you see all the footage about like snowboarding,
okay.
and
mm-hmm.
skiing,
mm-hmm.
and he wants to go back. He can't even stand up or talk. And it's like, I'm going back snowboarding.
He's, right,
and,
after
and
he's
you
real
know,
built.
You know he had a concussion, you know he can't do it. And people who go back have a very high chance of dying and getting crushed again because they lose their sense of balance. They lose their sense of danger also. It's extremely gripping. In terms of like sport documentary, it's great, but mm-hmm. also you see his family mm-hmm. and how they deal with this. And one of his brother is his development, and he's really touched by this. And mm-hmm. it's like you can't do this to me. You can't do this to me. I really love Crash Reel. And it's all. I mean, I like all the films, so
I know
could talk about every
of course.
Film, and I don't want to.
Well, let's make people
take some out.
Well, I think what's important favorite. For anybody considering checking out. BAM CinemaFest, and the tickets are currently on sale?
Going on sale for members at
okay.
the end of May and the week later for everyone.
Okay,
if
so
you're a member, like you
right.
get first pick, and
understand.
Some films will obviously sell out.
Right. So sometime in early June, tickets will go on sale, and we'll remind people. But
It's always good to check the BAM website also.
Yeah. I think you mentioned on the top of our conversation that there's usually a collaboration or like a cooperative event between BAM Cinema Fest and Rooftop Films. And this year it's Joe Swanberg's movie Drinking Buddies.
It's a perfect collaboration for Rooftop and Cinematheque. We both love the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of like doing this on a parking lot with free beer for the audience seems perfect. If you've seen the film, you know it deals with brewery. And I think Joe Swanberg is also very particular in his choice of beer and has experience working with a brewery.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be making sure that people enjoy the beer, and it's the right type of beer to give away during the screening. The movie is a lot of fun. he went out of his style a little bit by hiring like well-known cast like Olivia Wilde and Anna Kendrick. Mm-hmm. It worked really well together. It was really, really fun.
It was, yeah.
I like Joe's film. He makes a lot of films, so I always try to see mm-hmm. all of them or mm-hmm. as many as possible.
How do you find the time and where do you... Now, actually, you know, while you're at it, let me probe a little bit because I don't know you're that well. And how many films do you try to watch in a given week, let's say?
Well, during the submission for Cinema Fest, but I do pretty much this all day. So it's 5 to 8 films a day, depending. Sometimes you don't really need to watch a whole film to know that it's not necessarily a bad film, but you know it's not right for you or it's not right for the festival and you don't need to watch the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, even if you know it's not right for you, you get so caught up into the story or especially if it's a documentary that you still want to know what's happening. Mm. And I'm like, oh, I should really watch this other three because I have to watch them today, but I really want to finish this one. So it's a lot of movie watching nonstop. I mean, it's during the day, evenings, and weekend, obviously. We have deadlines. People want to know if they're in or not because they want to make other plans. And I understand that. I mean, you don't want to tell someone, well, I'm going to sit on this for 3 months and then tell you it's not in and good luck finding another festival. Mm-hmm. You always want to be considering the filmmaker and make sure that, well, I'm sorry if it didn't work out this time, but like I like what you do and send me your next work and we'll try
right.
again. So it's a lot of film watching.
Yeah, I bet. So again, we just want to remind everyone that BAM Cinema Fest, which is the annual summer festival under the aegis of BAM Cinematheque, and that the programming of Florence Almozzini. And this year, again, to check out the whole lineup of films, go to bam.org/BAM Cinema Fest.
We'll have a brochure also coming out soon with right. all the information.
So if you're knocking around Fort Greene or downtown, come by and pick up a copy or two and let all your friends know. I would always recommend go check out, of course, the full roster, but definitely see a couple that are wildcard films like that. Take a chance because everything mm-hmm. is going to be great. Everything is here is like the top-notch indie films. So you won't go wrong. So I think it's fun to sometimes just arbitrary.
You won't go wrong. If you don't have much time, you can always check like a short program because you get a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are like Brooklyn filmmakers set in New York with some really good docs and some really fun short films too. Opening, closing are great. And if people can see filmed in the Harvey Theater, we have a couple of spotlight events in there too, like Spectacular Now and Crystal Ferry. I think it's like a great event.
Okay. Well, I'll be there, I hope. I love coming. Yeah. So, again, it's the bam.org/BAM Cinema Fest. You can buy tickets there and check out the full schedule this summer. Thank you, Florence, very much.
Thank you, Adam.
I'll see you
soon.
Yes.
This is Jacob Shartov, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Next up and last is my interview with Torontonian filmmaker. Is that how you say it? Or Ontarian? Or Canadian, I guess any of those, Matt Johnson, who acts and directs and writes and edits The Dirties. You'll want to get over to Rooftop Films this Saturday night and check out that film. My conversation with Matt Johnson.
And you showed me to be free. And you showed me.
Hey, I know you guys are from the Toronto area. Where did you guys go to film school?
We all kind of live in the same general area, which is there's a street called Bathurst, which is a north-south street. And right. Basically everybody who worked on the movie or who we're friends with lives kind of on this row. We all went to film school together. York University. That's really sort of the only film school in Canada. It's the only film university there is. That's where I go right now, yeah. There's other ones, but they're mostly like film colleges and stuff like that. It's the only place where you can go to actual university.
Seems to have paid off. Tell me a little bit about how you came up with the concept of the Dirties. It's certainly of its time.
You know, it's funny, because when we were first thinking about making the movie, we weren't thinking that it was like going to be timely at all. Like, we were kind of working out sort of our feelings about Columbine, which was something that affected all of us when we were quite young. So to us, it was sort of something that had kind of passed its relevancy in a lot of ways, but something that was very much on the minds of us as young people, like school violence and school bullying.
Did you encounter it in your own lives?
Did we, like school violence? Of course. Not to the degree that that the characters in this film do, certainly, because this is a pretty unique story. Yeah, everything that we did in the film, we tried to have come out of actual experiences from some of the people, whether it was Josh Bowles, Evan Morgan, or myself, or Owen. Sort of the four of us were kind of dictating what most of the actual events in the films film would be. So, like that opening scene where Josh Bowles is grabbing my hand and won't let go, and is telling me to stop holding his hand, which seems quite childish, but almost like surreally malevolent. Like that was a real story that had happened to one of us, and so everything is kind of like an iteration of something that one of us experienced or saw when we were in high school.
Did you guys discuss specifically how dark you wanted the tone of the film to go beforehand?
No, I mean, we never... It's funny because to us, like, we were just trying to do it as realistically as we could. And so, like, the shifts in tone that occur weren't preconceived. Like, it was just what the character then started doing. I think it was almost like a great coincidence that those shifts like worked, and that then you were like, oh, like you believed the character as he went through these very dark moments. I think that was sort of like a lucky coincidence. We definitely didn't think, okay, and then it's going to get real dark and people are going to be like, whoa, I didn't see this coming. It wasn't like that at all. We were just trying to realistically follow this guy as closely as we could.
Matt, give us a synopsis of the film before we get started, so our listeners get an idea of what your film's about. It's so unique. And
yes, without sort of spoiling too much, it's basically the story of two friends in high school who get bullied quite a bit, but who are very, very close friends, and when it's just them together, they're kind of okay. And they decide to make a film about them jokingly killing all the bullies in their school. And you never really know when or how far they're going with it and what's a joke and what's real. And so you're basically watching what you don't know is turning into kind of a monster in the making movie, all under the guise of like a high school video project.
One of the fun things about The Dirties is you've kind of taken the conventions of, you know, found footage idea and kind of spun it a little bit by making The Dirties almost a pre-found footage film.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny that the found footage genre keeps getting attributed to this film, because that's something we definitely weren't thinking about doing. I'm not a fan of found footage movies at all. Like, what I really like and what we were doing before this and what I think we're interested in is fake documentaries. Like having everything done as though it was actually a documentary made by the subjects that you're watching. And never breaking those rules. That's something that I love and I think is so funny and so interesting, especially for first-time filmmakers. Kind of like Blair Witch Project kind of did it, or those, like Spinal Tap, but even they kind of break the rules. Mm-hmm. I think like a movie like Catfish is the best example. Like we were really looking like at Catfish and how they did that. When we were thinking about this film, just because those, like, that's an amazing fake documentary where you sort of see the conventions of making a movie as it goes. that we wanted to exploit sort of in the same way.
I think to this day, the Catfish filmmakers maintain that their documentary was completely real.
I'm sure they do. Why would they? They would obviously say that was a real documentary because they have nothing. They have no skin in the game. Like, there's no way that anybody would investigate them because nobody would care enough to launch an investigation into proving that it was fake. But if you make fake documentaries, you can tell in a second that was fake. Like, for us watching that movie, like, it's more impressive that it's faked than that it was real. So.
I remember back when I saw Catfish and it turning out nothing like I thought it was going to be.
Especially from the trailer. That's another genius thing those guys did, is that their trailer set up audiences to expect the exact opposite of what you were going in to watch. And so as you're watching it, you're kind of waiting for this weird dark turn. And because it never comes, you never question the reality of what you're watching. You're just like, I'm just waiting for the documentary to turn and get weird. And so you don't notice all the insane nonsense that they pull on you in the first two acts. But I love that movie. That was one of the best documentaries or fake documentaries I've ever seen in my life, easily. And also F for Fake, the Orson Welles documentary, I think from the 70s, was another big inspiration for us.
I didn't get those references when I saw your film.
Yeah, if you've ever seen that. In fact, there are numerous F for Fake references in the film that are quite hidden, but that's a big favorite of Josh Bowles and myself. We love that movie. We definitely don't make the references obvious. One of them is the way that I leave the class and then watch my own movie through the window. That's a reference to a story that happened to Orson Welles when he was watching The Magnificent Ambersons in tears in a hotel room that we learned about from that documentary. They're more hidden references for us than they are for people watching it being like, oh, man, that's a great F for Fake drop. Gosh, these guys must love Orson Welles.
Have you had many screenings yet?
Well, we screened it maybe six film festivals in the States, but we've only ever screened in America.
Oh, is that right? You haven't screened it in Canada yet?
No, we've never screened in Canada. We never screened for a Canadian audience. It's so funny. And when we screen in the States, everybody assumes that we're all American citizens. So it's been funny. Everywhere we screen, they just think we're American filmmakers. And we screen the movie and there's no, very rarely does that sort of Canadianism get brought up. I think because we don't handle Canadian money. There's no Canadian currency, which is normally like the giveaway for movies.
Right, and there's no mentions of hockey.
Yeah, well, these kids aren't really hockey kids. Although, I've heard people say that Owen and I have like terribly noticeable Canadian accents.
Yeah, well, that's how I picked it up because I had no clue going into the movie what it was about or where it took place or where you guys were from at all, that I picked up on the accent after a few minutes and figured it out.
So Canadianism, yeah. It's not something we were intentionally trying to hide or anything like that, but it was just...
Right.
Because you got to understand, when we made this movie, it was just like four or five friends right out of film school making a movie almost as a joke. We were sort of trying to just test the secrets that we'd figured out on a web show in a drama. So we were never thinking that we would... One, have to explain what this movie was about or why we made it. And two, we never thought we'd have an audience for this movie. Like, we thought it was just like a sort of a personal film. So, you know, asking about like what our intentions were, it's sort of muddy because we were kind of figuring it out as we went.
Have any of the reasons emerged about maybe why you wanted to make this specific film?
I mean, I know why I wanted to make the movie. I mean, I wanted to tell a story about like what my youth was like. And I also wanted to talk about sort of these issues of violence and bullying from the perspective of young people as opposed to the perspective of the news media or the perspective of just adults or psychologists.
There's so many choices you guys make, and it caught me so off guard when I was watching it. So I could tell that a lot of this was just all too real. And that's what makes the movie especially disturbing and scary.
Yeah, well, a lot of that comes from us shooting in high schools that are filled with real students who don't know we're making a movie. Like a lot of I think that feeling of spontaneity and like anything could happen and nervousness comes from just Owen and I not knowing what's about to happen in a lot of those scenes. So I think the audience is sort of with us in that, especially since we set that up in the whole entire beginning of the film where it's like, well, everything is just kind of happening off the seat of their pants. They have no idea what's about to happen. And then all of a sudden when it turns quite dark and those rules are still governing the film, you're like, oh, my God. I mean, that happens to me when I watch it. I'm like, oh, Jesus. These guys are going to kill everybody. What's going to happen now? Because you already have come to expect this kind of anything goes, everything is real, anything that could happen will happen. That that the turn, I think, is quite sickening.
So The Dirties ends on a very ambiguous moment, and we don't know what's going to happen, but I'm wondering if you, filmmakers, if you guys knew what...
The reason we cut there, and in fact, that was the only line that we'd ever written for the movie, that when I say that final thing to Owen, it was the only line we wrote. And we the cameras cut there. Like, we didn't, unlike other scenes where we just keep rolling to see what we get, we cut there intentionally because, like, that is the moment where sort of the news media would pick up the story. And so you kind of know what happens. Like, audiences intrinsically know the answer. In fact, they know the ending of this movie before they even sit down to watch it because we've heard it so many times. It's the exact same as every story like this of school violence where you just hear the same iterations of this evil person did this. We think this is why he did it, but he's insane. And like sort of his entire narrative kind of gets written off. And so we intentionally chose to stop this film at the moment where CNN would start reporting. That was always very intentional. And what happens after this movie, you know. Everybody who sees the movie will know exactly what happens after this.
I asked you about how many screenings you've had because I was kind of curious what the Q&As were like, given the subject matter.
Yeah, we thought we were going to get, like booed and people were going to be extremely offended. And it was unbelievable how, like, our expectations were completely reversed. People have been, like incredibly touched, thinking that or saying that this was so refreshing. And it was all been American audiences, so we thought when we screened in Park City that it was going to be like, you know, bloody murder. People were going to think that this was the most tasteless, awful film, but we've been really lucky. It's been the exact opposite.
Well, thank you very much, Matthew Johnson, star, director, writer, producer, and editor of The Dirties, which is going to have a screening with Rooftop Films at the Open Road Rooftop at Grand Street in Manhattan, 350 Grand Street, on Saturday, the 1st of June. He'll be there, and hopefully I'll be there, and hopefully you will be there too. Anyway, thank you, Matt, very much.
Yeah, I'm excited about this. I think it's going to be fun. Thanks a lot. I look forward to meeting you, man.
That's it, guys. Thanks once again for listening. And please do subscribe to Filmwax Radio on iTunes, please. And send in all your feedback to adam@filmwax.com, okay? This closing track, which I'm going to leave you on, is a number by this band, Hani Zara. They're going to be opening for The Dirties, the film The Dirties, on Saturday night at Rooftop Films, again at the Open Road Rooftop in the Lower East Side. So again, that's Hani Zara. Next week on the show, we have documentary filmmaker Marina Zenovich, who has a new documentary called Omit the Logic about Richard Pryor. It's outstanding, and it's going to premiere on Showtime on the May 31st. We're going to have her on. And also we have on John Biagi, who is the programmer at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which is coming to New York shortly. If all this other summer film wasn't enough. But that's a remarkable film festival, so you'll want to listen to that conversation. Until then, this is Adam Shartoff signing off with Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T.